Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program was brought to you by Patina Events at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, an idyllic location for weddings, corporate events, and parties of any style. Visit us at patinaevents.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're getting semantic to understand the deeper meaning behind some of the foods we love. First, we'll look at the big debate happening around the word milk.
Who the hell are you to tell me what is the name of my product and my landscape and everything we've cared about when, you know, you don't have anything invested in except to put out a little money to buy it? It's our entire life.
Then we get the lowdown on the language of cider.
So the first thing that's really confusing about dryness is that it has nothing to do with how something actually feels in your mouth.
And finally, we get our fill of tiki talk.
You don't walk into a tiki bar and be like, oh yeah, this is what Polynesia is probably like. Like, it's supposed to be like fantasy and stuff. That's the hard part. It's so easy to do tiki bad, and that's where it gets a bad name.
Tune into this week's episode of Meat and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Coop. Whoa, early. You're still going. What's happening? Am I on, Matt?
Yeah.
Ah, Jesus.
Yes!
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network. And listen, people, I was here before the clock turned 12:01.
Not
on time.
True.
Oh, it is freaking true. Before the clock turned 12:01, I ran with a Spinzall, all of my clothes and gear to go to Houston from the subway, and I made it here before it turned 12:01. I called in to our illustrious radio station here, which has no cell service, and said, start the announcements now so that we don't have to wait for me to get in. But no, there is no communication into the box. Nastassi just goes like this, I can't hear you, Dave. I can't hear you, Dave. And then I get here, so I want all of you guys to know I'm here before 12:01. Suck it and blow it out your backside, haters. Wow. Suck it.
I take full responsibility for our incredibly late start.
Glad we're off to such a good start today.
So, as usual, we have Anastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing?
Fine.
Yeah? We got Kat in the booth. I don't know why. She's just here with a camera. I don't really know. She's not at a mic. Sit at a microphone. You know you can't be in here without being in a microphone. You make it behind?
We're getting really good quality clips of Kat walking.
Yeah, you got good clomp. You got good clomp on the mics there?
Yeah, she's clomping.
Sweet. I got Matt in the booth. How you doing, Matt?
I'm feeling great. We already have a caller, in fact, but we can wait a minute.
You can wait like 35, 40 seconds, something on that in that range. And we have as our special guest today, author, podcaster, marketing, genius, entrepreneur, lover of food, Seth Godin. How you doing?
I am fantastic.
So how would you like us to call in all of, like, so, you know, in preparation, I was reading and listening to some of the podcasts. So I'm going to characterize kind of what I'm getting, which is, you're trying to help people figure out how to do something if they don't necessarily know the best way to get from A to B. They know they want to move. They know they want to make something, but they're not sure that they have kind of the best strategy to get there. Is that fair?
That's part of it. I think culture is a system, and if you see how the system works, you can make culture work for you and not against you. And I think that people are afraid to make things better, and I am trying to encourage them to make things better. Like you, I am against the enemies of quality.
Exactly. Yeah, Seth brought us some small wooden kind of ice cream spoony things that say enemies of quality on enemy of quality, which I very much appreciate. You laser those?
Yeah.
I have an interesting laser story we can talk about if we have time later. If you're interested, later we can talk about new design machines, old design machines, and the systems, and then lack of repairability on some of the new designed machines. And how that works out. But in the meantime, since we have a caller, why don't we? And I'm sweating like a just about to be executed pig. Why don't we take that caller? Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. How's it going? My name is Stephen from Washington, D.C.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
All right.
So I have a competition barbecue question for you.
Shoot.
Go.
So I have I'm not a ton of experience. I'm about to enter my first Kansas City Barbecue Society competition, and I've got some real questions about brisket.
Okay.
And so, you know, they do a lot of different injections that you can find kind of these proprietary blends of things you can inject your brisket with. And so there's always like a beef stock, and then there's matter and other ingredients. So they put monosodium glutamate in it. They put sodium phosphate in it.
Yep.
They put – sometimes there's like hydrolyzed plant-based proteins.
Yep.
And so I was wondering if you could point me in the right direction on how to start about one on my own if I have all those individual components.
Okay. So, I mean, all those are there because – here's what they're worried about. They're – barbecue is delicious. Before anyone jumps on me, you like barbecue, Seth? No? You vegetarian?
I don't eat meat.
You don't eat meat? Fine.
If I ate meat, I would love barbecue.
Okay. So the issue with barbecue is that the everyone wants to do it in kind of a traditional way, and the enemy of barbecue is dried
moisture management.
Yeah, moisture management. It's the miracle of moisture management. So that's what all those ingredients are there for. They're allowing you to beat the snot out of the meat and still maintain some moisture in it. So the hydrolyzed vegetable protein is there as a water-holding agent. The phosphates are there as a water-holding that actually makes the meat itself hold on to its water better at higher temperatures. And I forget what the other one you said was. The meat stock is there just to inject flavor into it and extra moisture that's going to be pumped out of it as you deliciously but viciously overcook it in the barbecue process. So, I mean, all those things, all those things work. I mean, I don't remember the percentages, but you can look up, I did once, I don't know if any of you remember Josh Rozerski? Yeah. He was obsessed with juiciness. He was obsessed. He kept, Dave, juicy steaks. Let's go talk about juicy steaks. He took me to the most uncomfortable dinner I've ever had in my life. The most uncomfortable lunch I've ever had in my life is with Nastasia Lopez, where she was completely angered that we were listening to somebody's discussion of their bowel ailments and other things, and in return got to taste more citrus than we have ever seen in our entire lives. But she has still never forgiven me for forcing her to sit through that uncomfortable lunch. The most uncomfortable dinner I ever had was at a strip club when Adam Perry Lang was, I would believe it was the Penthouse Club or something. I had to eat and discuss juicy steaks while people around me were getting lap dances, which I don't know. For those of you that don't know me, that's not my thing. I didn't appreciate the atmosphere of it. Doesn't make sense. Mixing that kind of stuff with food is not my anyway. So I kind of proved to him that juiciness isn't so important because I took sodium hexametaphosphate, and brined it into a steak and made the steak increase its weight by about 10-15% in water, and then cooked it, and lo and behold, I had a juicy but not so flavorful steak. So mostly, back in the old days, people would make stuff and it would be fine without any of that. I think all of that stuff's just giving you wiggle room. And so I'm also not opposed to it. The MSG is going to, increase the flavor profile. I would just start with some tests. Don't go too high on MSG. I think that's the mistake people make, is that when you add a little bit of MSG, it's great, and then all of a sudden you can tell that MSG was added, and as soon as you can tell MSG was added, it's a little bit off-putting. In the same way that ooh, salt, ooh, that's good, ooh, salt, salt, salt. And then at a certain point, that little bit of extra salt, you're like, ooh, my, that's salty. But MSG, I think, has a sharper inflection point. There's a wider range of properly salted things than there is a wide range of properly MSG'd things. The shrimp, the sodium hexametaphosphate, or whatever sodium, whatever phosphates you're using, you're not going to really, I don't think, I mean, you could look up the literature on it. That stuff's fairly widely available online. If you just type in phosphates, water holding capacity, meat, just type those things, phosphates, water holding capacity, meat, that stuff is pretty well defined even on the you can go find it literature and the non-technical literature, because industrial and commercial people use it. I'm not against that either, but just realize that, you know, you're injecting hopefully with meat stock or something with flavor, because there's a whole group of people, I happen to disagree with them, but people like Kenji who are anti any sort of adding water to meat because you're not adding, it's not flavorful, the water that you're adding. You know, I don't agree with that. Also, like, you know, there's Harold McGee, who, you know, I love and respect, also at one point said not to brine turkeys because then it made the gravy inedibly, you know, I have workarounds for that. Look, for every application of a technology or ingredient, there's secondary things you need to change. So, you know, I think all of it's valid when done properly. Have I answered this question?
If you want to win, there are only two ways to win. You win by fitting in all the way or standing out all the way. So to fit in all the way, you have to do it the way the current people are doing it, but even more. And if you want to win by standing out, you have to do it differently than the people who are winning are doing it. And that's the first choice you got to make.
Seth should be here every
day. Well, so I've got a plan or a part B for that question. It's related to that.
Well, hold on. Nastassi's going to kill you, but hurry up. What do you got?
Dave.
By general convention, they say that, you know, internal temperature for brisket should be somewhere between 195 and like 205-ish.
Yeah.
Why is it so high? Why don't they smoke to 160, lower than that?
First of all, when you're dealing with a traditional product, I'm going to go back to what, I'm going to go back to what Seth says. What you're shooting for is traditional brisket product. And traditional brisket, if you cook it normally, i.e. don't overcook it, right, it's incredibly tough because the connective tissue makes it almost inedible at that point. So the traditional way of cooking it is to cook it to a very high temperature such that the collagen and connective tissues render into gelatin. It's that gelatin that gives you the appearance that you haven't viciously overcooked it. Makes it, quote unquote, fork tender. But what you're fork tendering it into are kind of shreds of viciously overcooked meat, right? Now, that's the texture people are shooting for, and so that's kind of what they're looking for. They're looking for a juicy equivalent of that meat that can be pulled apart with a fork. And at 150, it's never going to it won't do that. What will happen instead? Let's say you were to cook it for 72 hours at a low temperature. Those fibers won't get as hard, right? They won't get like flaky apart like that. They'll get more mushy. You'll get softer. That's also not what they're looking for. And so I think, you know, Seth is completely accurate here. And he's saying, do what they want, just more. That's why they're adding MSG. It's what they want, but more. You know, like a little bit more liquid, a little bit more beef flavor. It's what everyone's looking for, but more. If you go outside of their textural parameters, you're going to lose. I'm going to have to say that in competition, food competitions especially, I've never seen anyone win by going completely outside of the box. I call this losing with style, and I think this is a valid thing to do, and I have lost many contests with, I believe, immense style, and there is honor in this. But in general, you never win in those kind of things other than by choice one, which is to do what they're doing, but more so.
Well said.
Okay, awesome. Well, on that note, I'm going to play around with some koji, so I'll let you know how it goes with the brisket.
Cool, thanks.
Thanks, bye.
All right, so Seth, what did you bring us today?
Well, I brought you a rye bread. There was a lot of debate. Should I bring you dal? Dosa I couldn't bring you.
Because it wouldn't last.
It wouldn't last. But instead, I went with the rye bread. I have a little grinder in my basement, and I buy the rye berries at Union Square Market. And the only ingredients I add are two kinds of barley malt, the powdered one and the liquid one, and walnuts. That's it. I have to add walnuts, even though my friend Ishita is deathly allergic to them. I just put a little sign up. No walnuts.
Do not eat these. Yeah, yeah. You know, I hope someday they can kick these allergies.
They're making progress. So here's the secret of the rye bread. The secret of the rye bread is a 12-hour bake.
So you have the super low and slow. So this is like full-on, like I would call it German-style full cornbread, like long, long bake, turns dark on its own, no caramel color, et cetera, et cetera.
No caramel color, but I cook it at 475 for an hour and a half, then I turn the oven off and go to bed.
So how much do you dislike people who associate the flavor of rye with the flavor of caraway seeds?
Oh, there's no, a pox on them.
Yeah, right. I think that's accurate.
Most rye bread has no rye in it, or just they wave a rye berry over the thing.
Right, and it's in the ones that use it are what's the standard? The standard American deli rye, New York deli rye is what's it called? Levy's? What's it called?
You don't have to be Jewish to like Levy's rye bread.
Yeah. So it's fine. It's a fine sandwich bread, by the way. It's a fine sandwich bread, but it's the rye is totally refined. I get almost no rye
exactly
flavor. So let's for those of you that don't eat, you know, the Danes also have a full corn brot.
Oh yeah, there's some tradition. Really good Danish stuff.
It's that whole middle and northern of Europe thing. Now listen, we're talking. It smells great. We're talking like this is like for those of you that live in lands where this is only in a supermarket, the brand of full corn brot you can get is relatively moist. Messermacher?
The one that comes like in a square and it's all sliced up and it sits there for a week?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah, it's not bad.
If you toast it.
It's very tart and kind of moist, but are you for that thinness level?
Yeah, I like it. When I cut this, I cut it as thin as I can.
Here, why don't you,
I'll try not to cut anybody when I do this.
Cut into the mic. Now, I don't know if you know this, but listeners of the show don't mind cutting noises, but hate mouth noises. They hate it. Yeah. Let's see here. I'm going to put my glasses on.
There are mouth noises about to occur, though. I don't know how to apologize for that. Nastasia, there you go. Yeah.
It's going to become an ASMR show.
I'll just bleep the next 10 minutes of the show.
Do you know that, like, my son Dax has started saying A, whatever the initials are, whatever the acronym is, and he doesn't have any idea what it means. I don't think he watches that stuff. You ready for a mouth noise?
Ready.
How about, I think people don't mind this particular noise. It's the flomp, flomp, flomp
yeah,
they don't
it,
like.
It has to be a low moisture noise. It's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay.
But now...
It's that, yeah.
Sorry, I forgot to bring radio-friendly food. That was my fault. I can handle it. The feedback is welcome.
Oh, the maltiness really comes through. You think the sweetness is conversion from... Are you using diastatic malt? Or are you using
both
completely...
Kinds.
Right, so... Sorry. It's got like a... I'm going to eat during the commercial break. I'm going to eat more. But it's definitely got a sweetness. I like it.
I like it.
I quite like it. I would like some cheese.
Yeah.
It's great.
Sorry.
I'm going to take some to Matt. I've got to go.
Okay. What?
It was so great to be here.
Thanks for coming.
Well, we haven't even got a chance to mess with you yet.
It was very thoughtful.
I am so sad. I will say, the mezcal tasting that I talked about last week is in the Times today.
Yeah?
It's all
so
thanks
when is
to
it?
You, Dave.
How is it thanks? Well, because we talked about it last week?
Yeah.
So when is the mezcal tasting?
It is April 26th, which is a Friday at 6:30 p.m. just down the street at El Cortez.
Do people have to reserve in advance?
There are tickets available online.
Where do they go?
HeritageRadioNetwork.org/sacred.
Okay. S-A-C-R-E-D.
That's right.
Perfect.
Thanks, Seth.
Seth Godin for the win.
Seth's so nice to me.
Wow.
I was saying, we need to have him here all the time.
Patina Restaurant Group offers unparalleled service in New York's most iconic locations, including Lincoln Center, Rockefeller Center, and Macy's Herald Square. Patina is also the exclusive caterer at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. From meetings and presentations in the glass-walled atrium, to galas in the renovated Palm House, and intimate wedding showers at Yellow Magnolia Cafe, your event will be perfectly imagined and customized at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. You can also enjoy a la carte brunch and lunch at the picturesque Yellow Magnolia Cafe overlooking Lilypool Terrace. Executive Chef Morgan Jarrett's unique menu offers warm, distinctive cuisine with a focus on local vegetables, grains, and sustainably sourced meats and fish.
Hey, are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Kathy Irway, and I'm the host of Eat Your Words here on HRN. Every week I sit down with food writers to talk about their newest work, from colorful cookbooks to food memoirs to exposés on the food industry. It's all meaty topic for discussion. You can find Eat Your Words wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave et al. This is Alex from Long Beach. How y'all doing?
All right, how you doing?
Doing fine. I have two questions, one relating to carbonation and one relating to a little cambio that I have. Relating to carbonation, I have a little kegerator that I use to carbonate my water. I live in an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
I do it at 34 Fahrenheit and 45 PSI, and it just comes out amazingly fast. I give myself a little acidic bath each time I do it. I'm wondering if there's any quality of life improvement I can have so it doesn't come out blasting at me.
Yeah, okay, so you keep the keg in a refrigerator and you carbonate it out of the refrigerator?
Yeah,
you're doing it at 45 PSI?
Kegerator system, yeah.
What kind of tap are you using?
45.
What kind of tap are you using?
Whatever came with it.
Now, that's your mistake. All those taps are garbage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people need to be people who sell things don't necessarily understand or use them. This is the secret. One of the secrets I've learned in like my life is that the people, just because someone sells it, does not actually make them an expert in the usage of said thing. What kind of tubes do you have? Are they clear vinyl tubes?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, this person might not be a bad human being, but those tubes eventually. I mean, maybe not in your house, but like if you were going to beat them up or have them in a professional environment, those tubes will fail. I only use braided tubes so that they don't fail. Also, I hate PVC. If I need to use PVC, if I buy from the beverage suppliers, they sell the cheap braided PVC. It invariably smells bad, makes me very angry. You can get, it's a lot pricier, but you can, if you must have a flexible tube, you can get braided Tygon. If you buy Tygon on Amazon, people will rip you off and give you regular PVC instead of Tygon. Tygon's a high purity PVC, and it's still, if you hate PVC, it's still PVC, but it tends not to smell, but it's, you know, on the order of like, you know, between like a $2.50, $3 a foot, somewhere like this.
Spring for that.
It's a lot more. Yeah, well, it depends on how many feet you're running, and you know, but it, you know, gas you can run in a regular braided PVC line. Please don't run gas in an unbraided line. Eventually, someone will puncture it, and if you really need something tough, get the polyethylene EVA jacketed stuff. It never imparts any flavor whatsoever, and I've never seen it fail, and I've tried to make it fail. Repeated abuse will not make it fail. Second thing, when you're filling up a kegerator, remember to fill it completely with water and then purge it out with CO2, then pressurize your stuff into it if you want to make sure that there's no air into it, if you're using a carbonator. If you're already getting a good enough... The reason you're foaming is, one, your tap stinks. Go get a Becker... don't get the Cornelius one, actually. It's been failing me. Get the Becker squeeze valve. Get that. That's the first thing you need to do to put into your line. Those picnic taps are the worst thing that's ever happened. The second reason you're not putting it through a cold plate. Second thing you need, because you're in a kegerator. Second thing I would do is run it through about 15 foot of hose on the inside of your 15, 20 foot of hose on the inside of your refrigerator to give it time to kind of like laminar and slow out before it leaves your tap. Try it. If it doesn't help, then take it out. There's no reason to have that extra tube there, but give it a shot. And the third problem is that it sounds to me like you have some air in your system. And when you have air, when you haven't purged it, like the thing I told you to get rid of all the air in by either you can pressurize and vent a couple of times at the top of the thing to get it to go. But if any air is remaining in your system under pressure, when you release the pressure, the things like nitrogen, which are and oxygen, which are almost completely insoluble, will form micronucleation sites the minute they come out of the tap and poof, foam out on you. So get rid of your air, maybe add some tubing before the outlet, and please throw away that picnic tap and get a decent tap.
And for those of you who aren't yet on the seltzer lifestyle, you have persuaded my son, who has built one in my office as well. You got the nitrogen seltzer, which you don't talk about enough on the air. There's a lot to be said for the seltzer lifestyle. It's worth a try.
You know, like you take water that comes in, which, by the way, I hate flat water. I won't drink it. Like my sons are like, you know, I will if I have to, when I'm forced to, if I'm dehydrated. But I threaten my family because I don't want them to put me in seltzerless situations. I threaten them that I will let myself dehydrate into a raisin rather than eat, you know, drink non-carbonated water. And so they kind of make fun of it, me for it. But honestly, you know, it's not, it's a little bit of a hurdle to like make your life carbonated, and it's totally worth it, you know, and it's actually, you know, if getting a soda stream is what it takes to get you there, then get a soda stream, but there are cheaper ways to have infinite seltzer. Anyways, hopefully I answered that question. Nastassi's like, I don't care. All right. So, what do we want to talk about? By the way, if you're going to listen, which one of the podcast, Akimbo is the one that you want people to listen to now or no?
That's my podcast. If they want to listen to it, that'd be great.
Here is a word to the wise. I'm stubborn. And so like I started listening to it in reverse. I'm like, I'm going to listen to the most recent stuff first and then go backwards. And I realized, not after the most recent one, because you didn't take questions on the most recent one, but on the one after that, that you were going to answer questions from the podcast before on this week's podcast. And for some reason, this didn't encourage me to then start working from the back and going up. For some reason, I'm like, I'm just going to listen to questions without knowing what the heck he's talking about.
Jesus.
And I kept on doing that. And then, like, later on, I'd be like, oh, now I get what that question was about. Anyway, so, so you know, a lot of, again, it's like, you seem to have like a very kind of open view of what a creator is, right?
Yeah.
And most of the stuff that I've heard you talk about or, you know, read, the work is aimed at people who want to do something, you know, creative writ large. You make new things, make things better, right?
Yep.
Focus on make things better. Now, here's a question for someone who runs, you know, or helps to run a bar or a restaurant, or, you know, Anastasia ran, you know, the outlet of Pasta Flyer, or Anastasia and I run Booker and Dax.
Right.
You're not always, and maybe you shouldn't even always be working with creative people, right? So, like, it seems to me that there's kind of a, and the other thing I'm going to say about your work, and then I'm going to let you go because this is going to get kind of like hard for people to understand if they don't already familiar with your work, is that a lot of, like, it, and this is kind of what I like, is that you're focused a lot on kind of your personal response, but in other words, inwardly focused, like what you can do about yourself. And the more I was reading, the more I'm like, okay, look it. I tell my kids this all the time. Don't be concerned about externalities. In other words, what's fair. Don't be concerned that that person has more money than I do, or that person has some sort of benefit that I don't have. Focus only on stuff that you can control about yourself. But the flip side of that is if you're designing a system,
exactly,
you do have to worry about kind of fairness, and not everyone can, you know, then I also have to worry about people that can't be creative. And what does it mean to be good to someone like that? It's not to try to necessarily force them to be better at being creative. Right. I mean, like,
I was with you until the last sentence.
Well, in other words, I have people who I think makes them feel completely uncomfortable to, there's people who really desire the safety of,
absolutely,
of
you
just
are correct,
knowing what to do.
It is a choice.
Right. So there are, yeah, right, right. I'm not, in other words, so your point is only, I'm going to let you answer it large, but in other words, your point is that someone who wants that safety net, give them that safety net, if that's, like, give them the chance to be that creative person, but then do you really think we should try to force someone to be that person, even if they're not?
So the reason that I love the two of you, and I do, and I've been listening since before you were famous and been to the bar, is because you have a growth mindset. And the growth mindset says things could be better. And once you acknowledge that things can be better, the next step is, and I could make them better. That I don't have to make macaroni and cheese the same way every time. I could make my macaroni and cheese better. I believe everyone at one point in their life has made something better. And once you can make something better once, you're a creator. And if you're a creator, you can do it again. And if we live in a culture where everyone is trying to make things better, then we can have interesting conversations about what does better even mean. Does better mean more open, more diverse? Does better mean just one person wins? Those are interesting conversations, but we have to begin with, guess what? You can make things better. And my career coincides with the birth of the internet. And what that means is you don't need CBS Radio to give you a show. You can make your own show. You don't need Julia Child to tell you you're allowed to cook something from a recipe. You can make your own recipe. And that's where Kenji came from, right? Like, who was Kenji? Kenji didn't have a permit, but Kenji showed up, shared something he had to say, and some people wanted to hear it. So in the face of all that infinity, my argument is see the system, make it better. And that's what I just keep saying over and over and over again. Be responsible for your work, and nothing is fair, but at least you can make it better.
Kind of related to that, I'm also a firm believer that just because, you know, there's so many more people doing things now, doesn't mean that everyone's that much. In other words, it doesn't make it that much harder for you to do something if you have something to say.
Right. Because you can be interesting. You don't have to be correct.
Right. And also, just because everyone can make, well, this is going to show my age, back when people actually wanted to make magazines. Remember when,
right,
when color printers first came out?
Yeah.
You're like, oh my God, anyone can make a magazine now. You don't need to work to make a magazine. Wrong. You still need to be good to make something good. Just because it's easier to make something glossy doesn't mean it's easy to make something good.
Exactly. So, you know, typography ran screaming after they came out with desktop publishing, but true typographers figured out that just because people have fonts doesn't mean they know how to make things that look good.
Right. What do you think about our belief in self in friendly self-loathing? Are you all right with that?
No, I think that the reason I'm not all right with it is there are already enough people in the world who want to, who get pleasure out of bringing us down, who get pleasure out of criticism. You don't have to do it to yourself.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like, I feel, don't you know people who have, I guess the drive for self-loathing stops you from becoming complacent, right?
If you use it properly, but what it really does is it gives you a place to hide.
Yes.
Because you're experiencing failure in advance over and over again.
Oh, yeah, but I'm all about the failure.
But you're not all about the failure.
I'm super pro failure. Here's the thing. If you don't fail, if you can't handle failure, you're never gonna succeed. If you can't handle
different kind of failure.
Yeah, you're working
We're talking about the failure of I did something to see. But if you fail in advance, did it. You're just giving yourself an excuse.
Yeah, yeah, I see what you mean. So you're saying it can be misconstrued. I'm all for doing things.
Right, totally down with that. It's just what paralyzes people. You know, I'll give a talk and people won't raise their hand. And then at the end, they all run up to ask you their secret question. Like, what was wrong with asking me your question in public when I was there to answer your question? Well, it might have been stupid. So you're willing to ask the stupid question in private, but you're not willing to ask the stupid question in public. That creates a cycle of constant experience of failure in private, which doesn't benefit anyone, versus your generous act of being willing to fail in public because you put something into the world and at least we learned one new thing that doesn't work.
Both Nastasia and my partner Don dislike most public questions because they don't think the person actually has a question. They just think that the person, how's the way you put it? They just want to say something.
They want to be heard. They hear themselves talk. They don't have a question for Dave. They want to let Dave know that they've been working on something.
Yeah.
Then those are the people that speak up. The people with actual real stuff don't.
I don't know. I have no opinion on this.
I know you don't.
No publicly shareable opinions on it. Okay, I'm just messing with you. Here's another one. You have an interesting idea on kind of, and this goes to, I think, to chefs and cooks a lot. So let's, you talk a lot about writer's block.
No such thing.
And it applies to, I would assume, any sort of I need to create something.
Correct.
Painting, cooking.
Right.
Now, so you want to talk a little bit about your view on writer's block first?
Yeah.
And then I can
It's controversial. I've been poked and queried on this topic. I think writer's block is invented. No one gets plumber's block. No one gets walking block. Where did writer's block come from? Well, if you look at the literature, it wasn't even used as a term before 1925. It was invented by Ernest Hemingway in The Great American Novel. That before that, writing was a thing you did in your spare time, and it wasn't a referendum on your quality as a human. It was just an act that you performed. And so if we say, I don't have any good ideas, what we're really saying is, I am not willing to work my way through an unlimited number of bad ideas on my way to finding a good idea. I just don't have the perfect one yet. So I was friends with Isaac Asimov years ago. I did a project with him. He wrote 400 books, published 400 books. I said, Isaac, how do you do that? He said, every morning I sit at this typewriter, 6:30 in the morning, and I type for 5.5 hours till noon, and then I'm done. And it doesn't matter if I type something good. I just have to type. And once your brain sees you're going to type one way or the other, your brain will come up with something decent. And the same thing is true if you're trying to develop a new recipe, if you're trying to open a restaurant, if you're trying to do anything. If you persuade the resistance, as Pressfield calls it, that you're going to do it and you keep doing it, sooner or later, one of your bad ideas will turn out to be a good one. So I've blogged every day for 7,000 blog posts in a row. And I don't blog tomorrow because it's perfect. I blog tomorrow because it's tomorrow.
Man. So I think, you know, part of what might be, I think that's true. Like people think that artists, let's just use artists or writers, they think that there's something super impressive going on there from a day-to-day standpoint. The same with cooks, anyone else. And I always say to them, having been trained as a visual artist, I am a trained artist, as we say. I have an MFA, though. It's no lie, I do. And the truth of the matter is that the veneration with which we hold people in creative positions means that we don't really understand what those people are doing on a day-to-day basis.
Exactly right. And I try to demystify that because I don't think Bob Dylan is a particular genius. I think he just ships often.
Well, I mean, the shipping is the thing. So when we look at people, we tend to think about the stuff that they put out in public,
mm-hmm.
right? Which, you know, for a musician, hopefully a writer, you know, hopefully is their better stuff, right? Or what they think is better.
Well, or,
can be.
Well, we got the guy with the brisket competition. He's finally bringing his brisket into the public.
Right.
Presumably, and that's a cause of anxiety.
Right,
private
right.
Private brisket is different than public brisket.
Right, right. But my point is that people ask me this a lot. So I've come up with some bar techniques, some food sure. techniques, things like this. People say, what's the next thing? I'm like, well, how should I know? How should I know what the next thing is? But that's, I think, where this whole idea comes from, that there are these kind of, and there are actually, in fact, massive leaps of understanding that happen through practice. It does happen, you know?
Sure.
But the fact of the matter is that you can't sit in a corner and wait for the good stuff to happen. You have to be working on a problem.
Right.
So right now, I'm working on problems with Nastasia on the next, product that we're going to make, which we can, I guess, tangentially talk about.
Tell us.
But then I, on stuff for the bar, I'm working on certain kind of technical flow problems, but I'm not working on any problems right now that are going to come up with a fantastic new style of drink.
It's not on the agenda today.
Right.
I want to interrupt for 1 second because you talked about this last week. My wife owns 4 bakeries, and her chief baking officer invented Fudgy the Whale.
Oh, my God!
And
did they know Tom Carvel?
Yes. She was 18 years old. Tom Carvel was her boss.
How was Tom Carvel?
Tom Carvel was a fine, fine man.
Oh, that's so nice to know.
When Kathy went to get a mortgage for her house, he was angry at her that she didn't just say, can you back this? And he called the bank officer without telling her to make sure that the mortgage would go through, the whole thing. So Tom, you can't leave the stuff in the tailor machine overnight.
Yeah.
And so he was frugal. He's like, what should we do? We need to make cakes with the leftover ice cream overnight and sell them tomorrow. And he said, so Kathy, and they say necessity, mother, invention. If Tom had waited for the perfect ice cream cake, there would never have been Fudgy the Whale, because Fudgy the Whale is an imperfect ice cream cake.
Whoa, did it start as Fudgy and then get turned into Santa? Or did it start?
So there were a lot of production problems because the tail can break. And so one of Kathy's innovations was making Fudgy fudgy, because if you make Fudgy vanilla, he doesn't have the structural integrity, and apparently chocolate or the crumbles or something gives the tail that thing. And then there was Cookie Puss and the whole idea of turning him upside down.
Cookie Puss, so genius. Right?
So Kathy talks, if you prompt her, a little bit about Fudgy the Whale, but I haven't heard all of the origin
story. We need to have both of you back here talk about Fudgy the Whale. First of all, for those of you, I'm just going to say this. I'm not an icing guy, but frozen icing?
There you go.
Is on point. And to know that I even know someone who came up with the ice cream cake with the crumble in the middle and all. Carvel ice cream cake. And I don't think it's just taste memory. I think they're good. I think that they're a good thing. I like them. Do you like them?
I certainly have a Proustian relationship with them. I don't think I would go out of my way to have one today.
I mean, but they're better than...
They're better than most anything, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, no offense, Baskin-Robbins, but I mean...
offense, Baskin-Robbins. We can say offense to Baskin-Robbins.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Come on, Carvel. And the memory for anyone who grew up on the East Coast, Wednesdays and Sundays at Carvel. I mean, the guy was Tom Carvel. Unbelievable. I'm glad to know he was a good guy. You know, does it bother you when you find out that people that you used to look up to were just vile?
Yeah, it does. And one of the things I've tried really hard to do is separate the work from the worker, because otherwise we're just going to have to throw out so many things that mattered to us.
Well, and I think going forward, that's going to become more and more of a kind of a problem. I think there's, once people have been dead for a while, they kind of, no one goes and dredges up their stuff, or you just don't care anymore. I mean, people aren't like, well, I'm not going to listen to Wagner.
Right.
You're like, well, you
you are, kind of. You know what I mean? It's like, it's tough to say. I mean, you know, I remember when I used to really idolize Chuck Yeager, who's a, you know, a famous test pilot.
Right.
And then, you know, when I was a kid, when I still idolized him, I found out that, you know, he was one of the people who was, and this may be wrong, but this is what I was told, and it affected the way I viewed it, was one of the guys who prevented African-American astronauts
exactly.
from entering.
Exactly. I was just
going to
mention that. New book coming out in 4 weeks. It's so good, about the Apollo mission on the 50th anniversary, and Chuck Yeager's got 3 pages in it.
And does it verify that?
It totally verifies.
And so, like,
but
you know,
mostly he was doing it because he got told to do it, and he didn't like being told what to do.
Oh, no. I mean, I met him when I was a kid. I used to go to the Experimental Aircraft Association meeting at Oshkosh to fly in.
Cool.
And, you know, I had a copy of his, you know, his book with him on the front with the Bell X-1, which was the first plane to break the sound barrier. Had him sign it. I was like, ah, Chuck Yeager. And then, like, later that year, he's a vicious racist. I was like,
yeah, I think he was just a vicious anti-disciplinarian. The hero of the book is Arthur C. Clarke. Which I didn't know.
The
science fiction guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I worked with him a long time ago. But so this guy is a troll, not Arthur C. Clarke, this other guy whose name I can't remember. His proposal, right around the time of Sputnik, was that the U.S. should launch nuclear weapons at the moon and make a giant crater that could be seen from the Earth as their example of just being able to piss on whatever they wanted and then be done. And it was Arthur C. Clarke who persuaded the United States not to do that.
Hey, can we still do that? can we go back and revisit this idea? Like, it's so funny. That's so, yeah, that's so like late 50s, early 60s thinking,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, hardcore. That's like back when the Soviets were trying to reverse the paths of rivers with nuclear weapons, only they actually tried it. I mean, were they ever successful doing that?
I have no idea.
All right. So back to see if we have any
issues related to
food
cooking.
Issues. Yeah, all right, let's do some. Nate Simon writes in, you might have something to say about this, because this is part safety, part perception. Nate Simon from Sactown, from Sacramento. What are your thoughts on Sacramento, Anastasia?
Fine.
You ever go there?
No.
You've never been to the capital of the state you grew up in?
No.
I've at least been to Albany.
I know. You're very patriotic.
What's wrong with being patriotic?
Nothing. That's your thing. It's not my thing.
Are you saying on air that you hate your country?
No, I'm just not patriotic.
What does that even mean?
I'm not outwardly... I'm just not as patriotic as you.
But, like, to claim this, I don't understand what it
means.
She's
wearing red, white, and blue, so you should cut her a little slack.
But, like, I just don't understand. It's like going out of your way. It's like when you say no offense, you're like, yo, I'm just not patriotic. That means there's some chip there. There's something I don't understand.
No, I don't know. Are you patriotic?
I think that there are trappings of patriotism that are often used in ways that aren't associated with what you're talking about.
Why can't we have him here every day?
Because he actually makes a lot of money for what he does.
Yeah, all right. Hey, guys. As I'm sure you'll agree, morbid fear of undercooking poultry often results in horrendously overcooked poultry. Truly said, Nate. According to everything I've read, intact whole muscle cuts are assumed to be internally sterile. Contamination with evil bugs like Salmonella and Campylobacter result from surface contamination, and unless the meat is punctured, the inside is still sterile. Well, I'm going to stop right there before we even go even further. Talk to any food safety expert, and they're like, how do you know it wasn't punctured? You know what I mean? And plus, there's lots of, like, nooks and crannies on a piece of chicken meat that there aren't necessarily in a whole, you know, in a steak. There are a lot of, like, you know, muscle separations, even on a chicken breast, lots of little places things can hide. And plus, unlike a steak, so when you're fabricating a steak, let's say you take a rib apart and then you slice the rib, there's a lot less knife poking towards that piece of meat than there would be in, let's say, ripping the breast off of a chicken. Okay? And also, every part of a chicken that you can touch is closer to the guts and to the processing area of the slaughter than almost any part of the beef that you're going to eat. So let's just start.
Yeah, that sounds makes sense.
From there. This is why it is considered acceptable to serve a rare steak, for example. If this is the case, why are we so hysterically obsessed with cooking poultry until the internal temperature is in the pasteurization range? The problem, Nate, isn't that we're obsessed with cooking it to the pasteurization range. It's that we're obsessed with cooking it well above the pasteurization range. We're obsessed with cooking it to a temperature where everything dies within like 10 to 15 seconds. And at those temperatures, at the 10 to 15 second death range temperature, you're looking at horrendously overcooked. It's 100% true that even in a, you can cook something until it's pasteurized and still have it look, to most people's eyes, viciously undercooked. So there is a wide gulf between perception of safety and actual safety, which is, I think, the real problem that we need to... Also, you know, there's a risk to eating, you know, anything undercooked, and I, as a semi-relatively healthy, you know, not yet hopefully immunocompromised individual, I'm willing to take this risk on the regular. So there's also that. Okay, this is the case. Why are we so obsessed with cooking poultry until the internal temperature is in the pasteurization range? Even more maddeningly, why do we freak out about undercooked chicken, but rare duck or squab is considered not only acceptable but desirable? Because we are hypocrites mentally. Not hypocrites. We... Okay, look.
That's a good part. I didn't expect that part coming up. That was a good ending to that question.
Yeah, well, the thing is this, is that people have an internal revulsion to, because of the way they're brought up, to looking at undercooked chicken or poultry, and for some people, also pork. So it's just, and they're not going to overcome that. So, like, this is not logic. Like,
but why duck different? I mean, with Passover around the corner, why is this poultry different than any other poultry?
Well, I think because we're raised to...
Even in, like, duck cultures? Are there duck cultures?
I mean, France and China.
So are they aversion? Do they have the aversion?
I think the French overcook their duck.
Okay. Well, now we've come up with something then. Duck works because it's a foreign-feeling poultry.
Right. It's allowed to have its own... Other. It's allowed to have its own temperature.
Yeah.
Right.
Good insight.
Whereas chicken and turkey, they can't. But you're not going to overcome somebody's... Also, duck has a different fundamental texture. Duck is more steak-like. Duck breast. Let's just talk about what we're talking about. Because, like, a rare duck leg is like, oh, my God. I have to, you know, I'm not going to spend all night at dinner. How much am I going to chew? You know what I mean? But, like a medium-rare duck breast has a steakier texture, I would say, than, not flavor, steakier texture than a chicken breast.
I think this is fascinating stuff, and you could do an entire show about fear of turkey because of Thanksgiving. Because it comes with so much overhead of your worthiness as a member of the family, and I think that spreads into food safety.
Well, because you're worried about poisoning your family?
But no, because you're worried about seeming incompetent, seeming lesser because you don't love to cook. And so we add all these side dishes that we don't eat the rest of the year, not because they're good, but because they're part of the trope of this is what it means to love your family,
right?
Is that you have this thing, and then what it means to be a TV watcher because it has to look like a butterball because they advertised that for 40 years. And all of that is the elements of culture that have nothing to do with the facts of will this food make you sick?
Right. And to piggyback on that, I think that equating love with the act of cooking can be extremely toxic. Mm-hmm. I think for those of us that like to cook,
right?
For those of us that like to cook, it is a good way to express our desire to do things for others by cooking.
Right.
For those of us that don't like to cook, it should not be made to seem like you must cook in order to show your love for others.
This is brilliant.
And I think this is a huge problem. And I think I know people that are guilty. We ordered out again. I was like, look, you're incredibly talented at other things.
Right.
You know, so my wife is like actually good at cooking. She doesn't enjoy it, but she sometimes feels very guilty. And I'm like, you're like an incredibly successful architect. Why should you have to want to cook? Like, why does this have anything to do with your, you know, ability to, you know, be, you know, to be a loving parent? You know, people don't necessarily have other people do their laundry for them, but if you could, you would, and you wouldn't say, oh, I don't love my family because somebody else is washing their clothes. You know what I mean? Like, right.
So family dinner is important, and my son works on family dinner, as is what his nonprofit does, not because of the cooking, but because of the sitting at the table together.
It's part. The breaking bread.
And we associate the two with each other when they don't have to be associated with each other.
You know, we had family dinner every Sunday for 2 decades. It, like the past, like as like a lot of members of family who live in New York have had their own kids. It's become less thing, but I think it's important to have a, you know, at least a standing invite like once a week to get. I love a family dinner.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my youngest, when the kids were growing up, we would cook dinner together every night for the four, but Mo and I would spend hours doing it because the actual act of cooking, not the part of I'm going to feed you, but the part of we're standing next to each other, that's just priceless. And so it's really interesting that when we're talking about, can I take the temperature of chicken down 1 degree, that's sort of turning it into a sport. But it's coming not from this basis of sport and competition. It's coming from this basis of this is how we define ourselves as humans. We're not all drinking Soylent all day long, automatons waiting to be replaced by AI.
I hope none of us are. People.
Yeah, exactly.
Although, what do you think? You think we're going to get replaced by AI?
I think that the number of people who lost their jobs to steam engines, steam shovels, who were ditch diggers was very large. And most of them in the long run were relieved. And I think that computers are going to keep replacing the part of our job we don't want to do if we can find the guts to be willing to do the other parts of the job that put us on the spot.
Right. So when I first started working at the French Culinary years ago, it was run by a French chef named Alain Sayac, who's still around. He's a cool dude. And because I was a tech guy, he always said to me that, you know, in his mind, my goal was to go Jetsons and to have, you know, all the food be in forms of, you know, pills or right. You know, and then he would point to people like Hervé Tisse who, you know, had his kind of mechanistic, we're just going to like, we're going to do, you know, the same way that they come up with antibiotics. We're just going to make a billion sauces and right. then, you know, and he was like, this is what you think cooking is going to become. I was like, well, I mean, I hope not. I mean, unless it tastes better than what.
Right.
Unless it tastes better than what a, you know, a thinking, caring person can do, then I hope not. But, you know, if it can do a better job, then okay. You know what I mean?
It's yeah, like, and a lot of those guys freaked out at sous vide at the beginning because it was so precise you couldn't do anything while it was underway.
Right. It was a different sense of, you know, a lot of that was just macho garbage.
Right.
You know, like, I can't, like, yell at it or whatever. You know what I mean?
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
Well, it's like, you know, look, I'm not talking too much out of turn here, but, you know, famous 3 Michelin star David Kinch, you know, now Michelin. Remember, like, so anyway, so he, you know, he once was talking to me, and he was an early adopter of kind of low temperature and sous vide, as was Keller. And there was a period of time, oh, I don't know, maybe 7-8 years ago, when those kind of chefs really started pulling back from sous vide and low temperature. Interestingly, I don't really know Thomas Keller. I've, you know, met him a couple times. He wouldn't remember me if I kicked him in the face. But, you know, when you even, I think his book came about on sous vide, low temperature, came out right around the time he was pulling back
right.
on using this stuff personally and in the kitchens. And so I said to Kinch, I was like, why are you, he had just gotten a new Bonnet. He was shooting for 3 stars. You know, he was chasing the star at the time. And I was like, why are you pulling back on sous vide? It's a great technique. And he's like, well, you know, I find I can get a better result by, and then he starts telling me like kind of super old school technique. So he's got this giant Bonnet, which is maintaining its, I think it was Bonnet. I don't think he was, I think he was Bonnet. Anyway, so in, out, in and out, in and out, in and out, not Multinet. I think he was Bonnet. He's pulling it in and out, in and out, in and out to get the texture right. So he's basically trying to do low temp cooking, like high right. input to make the skin or the outside the right texture, low input to not overcook the inside manually. And I was like, why? And you know, like why? When I can solve for those two problems separately. Like, so my whole life, the part of my life that's teaching people about low temperature, and Kenji doesn't agree with this, and he's wrong. And it's like you can separate the problems right. of, you can separate. There are two problems, getting the texture of the outside right and getting the temperature of the inside right. And yes, by being some sort of like ninja Jedi, you can get them to come together using old techniques, you know, and you can get them to come together at the same time and perform this minor miracle. But unless you do it all the time, the odds of failure are much higher and your odds of getting it right out of the bat are much higher than just controlling these two problems separately. You know what I mean? But for Kinch, Like, unless he was riding that line of I'm doing it this way, I'm putting all the input in all the time,
right,
it wasn't good for him anymore. You know what I mean? At least that's the impression I got from him. And I was like, man, I was like, because I have a theory, you will hate this, I'm sure, Seth, where, and the, you know, the more I see it in myself and other people, we have a limit. Like, we all have different amounts that we give a crap in general, right? But even the ones of us that give the most crap, eventually we bend and break. Eventually we compromise. Eventually we give up on something, right?
Yeah.
And I think we don't have an infinite amount of that inside of us. And so if you waste...
Conservation of crap giving.
Right.
Yeah.
So if I can separate these two problems of the texture on the inside, yeah, and the texture on the outside, and not worry about that being... That's so much more energy to focus on some other problem, exactly, that's messed up.
The problem is when we just routinize it and stop thinking. And so many people have been driven by our convenience economy to just swipe, swipe, swipe. It doesn't, nothing matters. Here you're saying you still need to give a crap, but let's conserve it appropriately.
Right.
Yeah, I agree, right, with that.
And then I said to him, so you don't use low temp sous vide at all anymore? He's like, no. I'm like, squab? He's like, okay, squab. I was like, I knew it. Let me talk about espresso machines for a second. So I have a vintage, like, late 80s, early 90s, La San Marco 85M one-group machine in my house, right?
I got the Olympia Cremini,
oh,
old school.
I'm giving a fist pump. It's a very strong move. Best cup of coffee I've ever had, which is going to sound crazy, espresso shot I've ever had, I've said this before, was from a lever pull, an old Vittorio Arduini, lever pull, at a trade show.
There you go.
And the guy comes up to me and he's like, would you like a shot? And this was a lever machine. I was like, yeah, sure. And he pulls the shot and I was like, oh my God. You know what I mean? Has ever happened to you? You're like, what are you doing at a trade show? You know what I mean? Like, you should be.
So can we do a pitch here for roasting your own beans? Because anyone who cares about coffee needs to roast their own beans.
All right, let me do this. I want you to talk about this and then let's go
tell
back
your
to beans.
Story.
So, and this is getting worse and worse. So I also had a problem with my Breville. The Breville Corporation gave me one of their Oracle Super Auto things, and I put it in a place where I wasn't going to be all the time so that someone else could just walk in, push a button, get the coffee, right? Grinds it. So on my La San Marco, one of the solenoids went bad in a spectacular way last week.
Ooh.
And the filling solenoid. So the thing filled up to the brim, then tried to pressurize itself, overpressured, and started spraying boiling water everywhere, all over everything. And I was like, oh my God. You know what I mean? So I open the sucker up and I diagnose it. But then I look at the solenoid part of it. Now, bear in mind, an old espresso machine is a lot like an old car. You can open it up, look at the pipes, and see what's going on. And so I was able to figure out what was wrong, like, fairly quickly. It was a solenoid. But then there's no replacements. So even in something old, right, that solenoid, if I would have had to buy the whole solenoid,
right,
from Italy, right, which would have been, like, a lot, or buy an American replacement and figure out how to kludge the plumbing together. And then that solenoid's like $100. I ripped the solenoid apart because, thankfully, it's all screwed together. It's not, you know, molded in. And the entire failure of the machine was due to a non-replaceable rubber disc,
yep,
that was sealing up the pilot orifice on the thing. It's not really a pilot, but you know what I mean.
Yep.
And I was like, and it was gone. It was eroded. And so I was like, this, my entire life is predicated on being able to have two or three cups of espresso in the morning. And my entire espresso game is predicated on this, like, you know, machine that's plumbed into my wall working. It, in turn, is predicated on this solenoid.
4 cent piece of rubber.
Yeah, and a 4 cent piece of rubber, non-replaceable, by the way, has failed. Luckily, you know, my partner Don has a laser cutter at work, so I went in, ripped the thing out, laser cut a piece of rubber, put it in, the machine was up and running the next day. And I was like, whew. But I had a similar problem on my Oracle where the three-way, so for those of you that make a espresso, there's a three-way valve on the group that either applies pressure from the pump to the group head to make espresso and then depressurizes it to atmosphere so that when you open up your group head, you don't poof. You know,
I have that problem.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, this one failed in the open so that it never pressurized the group head. It was always going into drain mode. You cannot get into that Oracle to save your life because modern design is not designed to be replaceable. It's designed to be as compact as humanly possible
and nothing, almost nothing, is easily gettable, replaceable, or standard, which means that a $2,000 machine can turn into a piece of garbage because literally inside of there, I know there is a 2-cent piece of rubber that has failed.
Yep.
And it's pathetic, and I understand the advantages of it, but then also, like, are we ever going to get back to creating things that are repairable?
Well, companies want to make something that's repairable. People don't want to buy it, and that's the problem.
Because it costs more?
It is more difficult to acquire in the sense that it costs more and is bigger and clunkier, and because most of the people who are buying this stuff don't use it the way they used a 1948 Chevy pickup truck. They're using it for 3 years and then moving on, or they're putting it in their fancy kitchen and never even turning it on. So they're, the consumer is voting over and over again in favor of convenience, not in favor of longevity and control. And even when people buy, if you go to Maker Faire, right? The Maker Faire store, which should be filled with tools like we're talking about, is filled with kits, because kids are taught by their parents to follow the instructions, make the kit. And that's what saved Lego. Lego was going bankrupt selling normal Lego. And only when they invented kits with instructions did they save the company.
So you're saying...
I hate this.
You hate the
I hate this.
The kitification of...
Yeah. Because who's going to invent the next thing? We need more engineers.
Yeah. I love it. Well, you know I like engineers. All right, so let's talk about roasting beans before they kick us off the air.
Okay, so real quick, Marco Arment, the guy who invented Tumblr, comes over to my house because my Slayer is just not making good coffee, and he lives down the street, and he loves coffee. He says, I can't help you. I said, why can't you help me? He says, because you don't roast your own beans. Wow. Once you roast your own beans, we can talk about this. So I went to Sweet Maria's, which is a website, and you can buy a Korean coffee roaster. It looks like a tennis ball can. It's $350. Pays for itself after 20 pounds of beans.
Which one of the roasters is that? I stopped ordering from them, even though I thought their green coffee was better than the other suppliers, because they had a hack problem once.
And really?
A bunch of credit card numbers got stolen. Yeah. They probably fixed it.
They're
good people.
They are good people.
All right, so yeah.
And then instead of like venting, the way Marco does it, he only roasts on nice days. He brings it outside to roast. I pumped a hole in the laundry room window.
There you go.
Right? And ran a dryer vent out. I haven't burned my house down yet. And it's better.
Does this roaster have a catalyzer on the outside?
I don't know what a catalyzer
is. So check it. So I used to do... Is one you're doing mimicking drum, or is it mimicking air?
It's drum.
Drum.
And so I only roast like a pound every 2 weeks, so it's not like I'm...
Right, but you're a drum guy.
Apparently.
Right. So, I mean, like, the big thing you have to decide in your life is, are you an air person or a drum person, right? So Michael Civitz, who wrote one of the more important, like, technical coffee books of the, was it in the 70s, I guess.
Maybe we'll even say the most important.
Yeah.
Given that it was 50 years, 40 years.
Yeah, AVI Press, right? Probably the single most important book after Euchre's All About Coffee in, you know, the early 1900s. Anyway, so he came up with this idea. I think he wrote the book. Anyway, Civitz Roasting. So he was using fluidized bed roasting, right? And then a bunch of home people were like, well, an air popcorn popper is pretty much like a fluidized bed roaster. And so there was all those early air popcorn people, but those produce a very different roast profile than the drum. So I started roasting, and there's his name is David, last name I think is David, or first name is David. He wrote the early book on home roasting from the late 80s, early 90s, if you know who I'm talking about.
Don't know.
And his point is, don't worry about it, just start roasting.
Right.
He's like, don't worry, you're not going to be as good as the best roaster. Don't worry about it, just start roasting. You know what I mean? And so I thankfully read his book relatively early on, and so I consequently know how to worry, but I don't necessarily worry, because I'm not trying to always beat the best person on earth. You know what I mean? So I started as an air guy, but I would perpetually burn them out. I bought a couple of the Purpose Made early coffee roaster that were based on popcorn roaster technology, yeah. And I fry them, like, because I would roast all the time.
Well, I've had really good luck, 2.5 years.
Really? And is this air, but it's drum?
Well, the tennis ball can rotate, asymmetrically.
Oh, yeah, I don't have this
and
one.
So it's got a little computer chip, you tell it how long and what temperature, and it just does its thing in 34 minutes later, it's done.
So I built a drum. I built a mini drum roaster that is similar to the Burn sample roaster, which I love, and it lets me look at it. But the problem is, obviously, and it's a long way to get to it. The problem, people, is the smoke. The smoke is intense. Yes. So if you
it doesn't smell like good coffee. It just smells like coffee.
Yeah, and also it's. By the way, did I talk about this last week? Air quality.
I wasn't here last week.
Oh, anyway, yes. So like...
We talked about a lot last week. It was a good show.
Oh, thanks.
Except we missed Nastassia.
Except, well, you know. So this is not like a friendly smoke. This is a full of crap, sticky smoke.
Carcinogenic, no?
I mean, unclear. I don't think anyone's done this study because there's not enough coffee workers. But here's an interesting fact. The next time you roast... in a place where you where so my roaster has a hole 3 inches across, and that's where all the smoke comes out of. If you hold an open torch right at the opening, it burns all the smoke. And professional roasters have like almost like an afterburner, a catalyzer that will fully combust the smoke, and it goes clear, and then it doesn't ruin everything. So you can. Really mitigate, and I think there might be one of the higher end home roasters that can do this. That can mitigate the smoke that's being made.
Makes sense.
Yeah. The other thing, how does this thing cool? Does it have a cooling tray?
Yeah. Then then it just keeps going after the cycle is done until it's at room temperature. So it just keeps spinning until it's cooled.
Because I never did that. So like I stick it into a tammy, which amounts to like a winnowing thing.
Right.
And I sit there and I toss it up and like toss it back and forth. And this chaff gets
at this point, everywhere. It's worth you just going to a roaster and buying some coffee.
Well, no, I mean, here's a nice thing. Let's say, people, that you're in a place and you know you're not going to be there. You're only going to be there. Let's say you have like a place you're only going to be a couple times a month, right? It's hard to necessarily keep good coffee there.
Good point.
You can keep good green beans. They last a lot longer. You show up.
The best part is just being able to say to people, want some coffee? I roasted the beans.
Yeah,
that's what it's all about for me.
Here's another thing. People say you have to wait after you roast the beans. You know what? You don't.
Really?
It's just different.
Okay, because I've been waiting.
You can. Look, the problem is that it's evolving more CO2. It's evolving CO2 more rapidly right after you roast. I mean, that's the main problem. I mean, you have to wait for it to be cold. Well, you know what I mean? Yeah. But
like I try to have a 5-day cycle.
Yeah, but in other words, like, it's not the same. This is what I'm saying. It's not the same, but it's not like you're going to die of poisoning by having the coffee right after you roast it. It's just different.
Right. Now, and we keep changing the definition of what good coffee is supposed to be. I mean, like, before Howard Schultz showed up, people said good coffee was something different. And then after people got over the Howard Schultz thing, people said good coffee was something after that.
I know someone, who was it that was talking to me, that he felt really, someone who's, he was a cool person. I forget who it was. He was like, am I a bad person because I don't like these kind of like high acid fruity coffees? And I was like, no, you're not a bad person. Just tell people what you want. Right. I was like, people who produce those coffees can produce other ones.
I mean, if you like milk chocolate, you're a bad person. But
what about these new, what about the new good milk chocolates? You had these?
What, were they use nuts instead of milk?
No, where it's just like they're like, it's like low sugar, high cocoa solids. There's like, that's a whole new thing, the fancy milk chocolate.
That might be possible. All but right. I'm just saying I'm giving people less slack when it comes to chocolate because there is an axis there. But with coffee, you can go into different quadrants and be very happy.
Yeah, I like a less whiny. I said, if you want to sound like, it's like, it's not too whiny.
Yeah.
You know, I don't, not a lot of like, not a lot of berry and red fruit in it. And then they'll be like, oh.
Yeah. And you can even give you ask for it to be chocolatey.
Yeah, they'll give you, and they'll give you what you want.
Exactly.
Right?
Chad has a question that I think is on this topic. I want to hear about the Slayer. Worth it? Question mark.
Go for it.
Yeah. I don't think the Slayer is worth it. I loved looking at it, and I loved how much technology was in it. I felt like it totally disconnected me from the act of action. That's why I went straight to the manual lever after that. And I was able to sell the Slayer for a fine price, so I didn't feel guilty about it. And it's beautiful and brilliantly engineered, but I felt like I had no idea what was going on.
And your lever is commercial style engaged spring, not levered direct on piston, right?
I pull it down and the coffee comes out while I'm pulling it down. So it's as direct as can be.
So it's like a La Pavoni.
It, but without all the eagles and stuff.
Right, right. But in other words, I used to have, I still have, if anyone wants it, I'm going to sell it soon because I just have no space for it. But I have a micro chimbley, which is the smallest machine that works on the spring lever principle. So like right. most of like the Vittorio Arduino, you pull down,
exactly.
the coffee appears as you release.
Right.
Because you're engaging a spring.
Right.
And what I love about those machines is that, you know, pressure profiling is all the rage over the past 5 years. But the pressure profiling, anyone that really cares about pressure profiling is building that pressure profile on the fact that lever pull machines make, I'm sorry to say this, not as much crema, but a better tasting cup of coffee, like espresso, to my taste, for what I want. I don't really care about the crema that much. I know some people get rid of the crema, I don't know. Anyway, I'm not going to get into it. But anyway, the point is that the pressure slowly getting less over the course of the shot actually has an effect on the extraction that I happen to like, right? So in the late 90s, early 2000s, everyone was all about, oh, static pressure. The pressure has to be 100% static, right? And so they're like, if you don't have a Procon pump in your machine, which is a vane pump that can provide a relatively static pressure, assuming your inlet pressure is good and its pressure override is good, it will provide a relatively static pressure. You can look at your needle and it's pretty rock solid, especially if it, and they, all the good systems have damping in them. So the system is really rock solid. And they used to say, well, you're never going to get as good a cup of coffee with what they call a Euchre pump, which is a reciprocating. So if you have a machine that goes like that, it's never going to provide. They don't have the system doesn't have the damping to provide an even enough pressure with those. I don't think that's necessarily true. But anyway, everyone was focused on that. And then the pressure profilers realized, wait, these lever pull machines make this awesome shot. And it's, you know, it's because it's reduction in pressure. Right. And then hence
and the Slayer lets you do anything. You can set the curve any way you want. And if you're the kind of person that wants to make 30 cups and not lose your sense of taste along the way, you can tweak it. For me, it was too much data. And I just like feeling the coffee pushing back against me as I'm pulling the thing and feeling like I'm gaining skill. That's why I do it.
But also, that is valid. Like, in other words,
yeah, it's fun.
Even if the coffee is not like, even if like in a blind taste that you would prefer the coffee out of the other machine, the enjoyment of making it the way you want to make it is a valid enjoyment.
Because we're not double blind.
Right.
Exactly.
You're not. Right? You should do what increases your overall enjoyment.
Bingo.
Anyway, it's been a pleasure having you on, Seth. Please come on
a
again.
Thrill.
So wait, Nastassi, but on the way out, what is this?
I have to open it.
This is because I've written so many blog posts, twice we've made these collectible editions. So it's an 800-page, 17-pound book of the last few years of my blog. Almost no one has one, but I wanted Nastassia to have one.
So it's not on topics in relativistic physics?
No, we put it in a mailing box to confuse people.
I was like,
and part of it's written in Polish and part of it's Einstein on the spine. And I got this note from this guy, and here's a knife. I got this note from a guy and he says, I received a package from you and I did not order it. And I write back saying, I write back, that's the $195 book you bought. He said, no, it's not. The book you sent me is in Polish. And I was like, did you open it? And this is all by email. So it's one a day.
Oh, my God.
And finally, he gets back to say, oh, thanks. Here, you need more knives.
You're like, oh, you can't read Polish?
I don't want to ruin that. Here,
just
David,
cut the tape. Anyway, pleasure.
Thank you both.
You know, when you have time, please come on again.
This is super fun.
I'm sure people will enjoy actually having things they can use.
You have contributed so much to my family and our delight in listening to you guys.
Anastasia
so
just
thank
shredded
you.
The box. So anyway,
did not
this has been Cooking Issues.
Cooking Issues is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.